Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to the Gallipoli Club for providing this great facility again. Tonight we've got a discussion between Stephanie Dowrick and Blanche Dauphagé. Blanche was here during the first book in her planned quartet, The Young Lion, and this time on the occasion of The Lion Rampant. So I'll introduce Stephanie briefly and Blanche a little less briefly. Stephanie Dowrick is a writer and a social activist. And Blanche Dauphagé is an author initially, I think it's fair to say, non-fiction, but in more recent times, fiction. She's an acclaimed novelist, biographer and essayist, and her books include Mediator, a biography of Sir Richard Kirby, Monkeys in the Dark, which won the Penn Jubilee Award, Turtle Beach, which won the Age Novel of the Year, and the South Australian Premier's Award, Robert J. Hawke, a biography which won the New South Wales Premier's Award, Winter in Jerusalem, and White Eye. And Turtle Beach, of course, was made into a film featuring Greta Scacchi and Jack Thompson. And all of Blanche Dauphagé's novels have been translated into other languages. But as I said, she's here on the occasion tonight of the release of The Lion Rampant, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of that, plus the earlier book, The Young Lion, for later on. But now we lead off with Stephanie Dowrick. Many thanks to Stephanie and many thanks to Blanche.
Thanks, Jared. Well, it's a real delight, of course, to welcome you to what I know is going to be an absolutely fascinating evening. And thank you to the Sydney Institute for asking me to speak with Blanche this evening, because I read the first book, in fact I reviewed her first book in this series for the Herald and praised it. And at the time that I read the first one, and even more when I read the second one, I realised that what Blanche has taken on is an extraordinarily daring, courageous feat, not only creatively but also intellectually. The amount of research that's needed, but not just research, a kind of depth of comprehension, not just of the characters, but also of how characters move through time and were affected by event at the time. Those are the demands of historical fiction, and when it's well done, it's absolutely brilliant. And of course, it's also an area where it's really very, very easy to fail. So I have admired Blanche's courage so much, and this evening I really want to focus mostly on the story behind the stories. The stories themselves are so rich and so fascinating, but I think that we have the opportunity here with Blanche being here with us to really hear some of what has evolved within her that has allowed this great feat, and she's only halfway through this enormously ambitious project. But I thought that there might be some of you here who haven't yet read the first book, and so I wanted Blanche to give us a little bit of the feeling of it by reading two short passages. So that's how we're going to start.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. And again, thank you, Gerard, for inviting me. And thank you for coming. But I'm going to read from the second book, not the first.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yes, okay. This is just the opening scene. One autumn morning, when sunshine had burned the sea mist away and the outside air grew heavy with the scent of apples, the Duchess of Aquitaine looked from a window and saw the crew of a fishing smack arrive at the gatehouse of Rouen Palace. Guards with halberds demanded to know their business. When allowed access, the men trudged up a path towards the entrance reserved for villeins. Eleanor understood immediately. Across the channel, King Stephen was dead. Her young husband would be the next ruler of England. At each weary scrape of the men's clogs against the stones of the path, her heart leapt. Wild southern music rang in her soul. At last, revenge, she thought. One's mind moves with images as swiftly as angels' wings. She snatched her infant son from his nurse to carry him to the arrow-slit window. Mama will be a queen again, Shushu. You, Willie, will be the English crown prince. It was more than a year ago and 10 days' ride away, but it seemed like an instant. The shouts of joy from her midwives when they lifted from the birthing tub a mass of raw red flesh. A boy, they cried. Duchess, you have a son. She grabbed him, slippery as a fish and herself as wet as one, the cord connecting them still throbbing. Finally, the triumph of an heir.
And will I read
this? Yes,
okay.
So this is another little bit. This is from chapter 4. A clear blue sky winter morning greeted the coronation crowds. Henry and Eleanor, each mounted on a destrier caparisoned in crimson, rode from the crumbling, war-damaged palace of Westminster to the Abbey to show themselves to their subjects. The Abbey and every building nearby flew the standard of the new king, two gold lines on a red ground. When Henry raised his blue velvet hat to wave it at the mob, arrows of sunlight flashed from his hair. "He's crowned already," someone shouted. People ignored the swords of knights guarding the royal couple and rushed towards them, in their excitement forgetful of the danger from horses' hooves. Henry was sending mental pictures to both steeds, ordering them to stay calm, not to rear. He blew kisses to the women and gave military salutes to men who came to the doorways of their shops, wiping dirty hands on work aprons. Eleanor held out her arms and gave them joyous laughter. "Look at her belly, 7 months gone," women said. One yelled, "Highness, when will the baby come?" Eleanor did not understand English. "Prince," she called back, patting her side. The French word was close enough. The crowd yelled and clapped. Henry leaned from the salad to heave a child from its father's arms to sit in front of him. With his left arm cradling the boy, he wrenched his sword from its scabbard and shook it above his head. Tears stood in the eyes of old men and women. "We've got a real king again. Long live Henry!" Henry tossed his hat to the crowd, hands snatched for it. A man cried, "A new sun shines in England's sky."
I think that some of you know that after having a very successful writing career, Blanche had some years of not writing, where in a sense she was storing up her creativity. So what I'm very interested to know, with all the kind of inspirations that fleet across a creative mind, I really want to know, before a word was put on a page of The Young Lion, which was the first in the quartet, I want to know what really pulled you to this one. Pulled you to this medieval period, pulled you to Henry, pulled you to Eleanor?
Well, I'd been interested in the 12th century since my 20s, and I'd done a lot of reading about it. And then when I started thinking of the great figures of that century, Henry was more or less an obvious choice, because he was one of the greatest kings in English history. He was founder of the Plantagenet dynasty, which is still the longest lived dynasty in England, and he was also the bringer to the world of the concept of the rule of law. And I've lived in countries where there is no rule of law and greatly appreciate somebody who brought it into government. He was an extremely good king as a governor. He was a very thorough king. And it was a fascinating age, and he was a larger-than-life character. And Eleanor, of course, is one of the most interesting women in Western history. She was... she stood up for herself big time.
Absolutely.
Yes, and sometimes under incredibly difficult circumstances. But what I want to know is that when you began this, did you think of it as a quartet? Were you kind of in that marvellous phase of, you know, innocence and rapture of a love affair, you know, beginning something as daunting as this? Were you daunted or were you just ecstatic?
Oh, Stephanie, you know how reckless writers are. They just rush in. No, I was ecstatic. I did think of it as a trilogy to start with. And it was only as I did more and more research that I realised it had to be a quartet. At the end of the first book, I was still thinking it was a trilogy. It was only halfway through the second book I realised I had just enough for a quartet. Yes, I rushed in. I didn't feel daunted, and I was madly in love with Henry.
Yes, I think we can get that sometimes when we're reading this book. Though you have your fondnesses for some of the other characters too. Before we talk about those characters, and they are incredibly fascinating, there are four characters, by the way, in The Lion Rampant who are front and centre stage. Henry dominates, and sometimes I was startled, and I think that Blanche meant us to be startled, because every now and then she reminds us how young this king was when he was already achieving so much. You know, suddenly he's done this and he's done that and he's, you know, conquered here and he's conquered there, and he's 23. I mean, it is kind of shocking how accelerated his vigour and his sort of breadth of conquest was. But before you got to all of that, you've had to do research. Can you tell us something about how you research and what you look for, and then where research kind of moves into your whole imaginative comprehension of this time?
Well, that's the mysterious process of writing that mm-hmm. I don't understand, and I don't know that any writers do understand it. But I did, obviously, an enormous amount of reading of the very serious blockbuster histories, huge things like this. And I did a lot of work in the libraries, and I also, obviously I've been to England and France many times, but I went back specifically on a tour to 12th century palaces and castles and abbeys, anything that I could find the ruins of, just to look at the landscape, if for nothing else. And gradually, through a combination of things and that mysterious process, it's a kind of yeast, the characters started to come alive for me, and I now know them and know what they'll say and what they think and what they want to eat as well as I know my best friends. Yes.
Yeah, probably better. Probably better in some way, because you also have more control. So these four main characters are very, very fascinating. So there's Henry, obviously, you know, the young lion who's now the Lion Rampant. There's Eleanor, and it's almost impossible to think about Eleanor without seeing Katharine Hepburn's face. I wasn't entirely convinced by Katharine Hepburn Eleanor.
No.
Eleanor's more complex in my mind. In this book, there's also a very brilliant, totally amoral, very young man called Aelbert. And I tried to find out where you got this name, Aelbert, from, and I'll ask you in a moment. And then, of course, very strong within this book is the very complex character of Thomas Becket, who represents a kind of gluttony for power. They all have pretty rampant gluttony for power. But I think that Thomas has it most of all. So I want to ask you more about that gluttony for power and what it tells us. But first I want to ask you a much simpler question, which is that did you feel quite early on that this was your story to tell, Blanche? Did you feel a kind of, that you were in service to this story somehow?
Yes, absolutely. And it's one of the things I seriously want to do, as I almost say, I pray for, that I do justice to Henry.
To Henry?
To Henry, yes. Well, to Henry in particular. It's very odd. Nobody has ever written a biography of him in either English or French. There have been histories about him. And what I realised only when I started book three was that I'm in fact writing his biography. And I didn't know that before.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's very interesting to me, having read these books so thoroughly that, yeah, I really feel that. So in giving yourself also to these other characters, maybe we need to go to the most difficult character of all. Well, there are two very difficult characters, and in a way, one's a younger version of the other. But Eobard is a fictional character, we suppose. Thank you. We suppose. Though he lives truly in Blanche's mind and creative imagination. Thomas Becket, of course, some historians are going to argue with you about your understanding of him and your presentation of him. Can you tell us a little bit about how you arrived at this quite controversial picture of this really quite well-known person in English history?
Well, what's controversial about it is that I say he was a sodomite. And I say that based on pretty good historical grounds. When he was Archbishop, he surrounded himself with what he referred to as the erudite, the scholars, and those who didn't like him used to call them the catamite, his catamites. He was extraordinarily flamboyant in character. He was in every description, including those done by people who were great admirers of him, he was in every way a queen, a really over-the-top, marvellously brilliant queen.
Yes, but he was also unkind in many ways. He was untrustworthy in many ways. And this overwhelming desire for power really, in a sense, costs him the tenderness that he so desperately wanted.
His unkindnesses are historical.
Yeah.
He was ruthless and merciless in putting people to the sword and whole towns to consign to the flames. I've got all of that from the straight histories. And also his craving for power. He was a commoner. He was just a London banker. His nickname was Oily Tom when he was working in London. And he craved the glamour of court life and the glamour of power and was determined to get it. And it does seem that his mother had very much encouraged him in the idea that he was born to do great things on earth. And he followed what Mama said.
And I'm going to ask you a bit more about Eleanor, but I want you to tell us a little bit about this strange boy, Eobard. who's about as untrustworthy as you could get, but also extraordinarily brilliant. And you have a kind of fascination with his brilliance and almost a kind of forgiveness of his amorality. Do you?
You asked before about the name. Ael is the word for elf, so it's just bad elf.
Bad elf?
Yes. And
what a bad elf he is.
He is an extremely bad elf. Really, he is a Luciferic character. Yeah, yeah. He is the Satan in the Garden of Eden, or in this beautiful court, which in many ways is like a latter-day Camelot. And indeed, he has a very strong connection with Servant.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Lucifer was brilliant and beautiful.
Yeah. And immensely seductive.
So that's really interesting, because in the first book, and I hope that you'll be walking away with both books this evening if you haven't got them already. In the first book, there's a very lovely, complex, kind character, beautiful character, called Rachel. And we won't tell you very much about Rachel, but in this Lion Rampant, the character who has most kind of natural tenderness and warmth, particularly as the book develops, I think is the half-brother of Henry, a man who goes through an extraordinarily interesting transition, and his name is Guillaume. Did Guillaume, for you, in this second book, carry some of the goodness that is sort of to balance Elbert?
Yes, he did.
He does,
yes. And he was a very good character a good person in the first book as well. He was a very good hearted person, but as he gets older and as he goes through the terrible suffering that he does, his goodness becomes stronger and sweeter. He was an historical figure.
Yeah.
In the first book I called him Guillaume because halfway through this book he changes his name to what it actually was historically. And it's a funny thing, I made up a story, what I thought was something about him, and then months and months later I discovered it was true. So these are the very strange things that happen when you have done your research.
Oh yes, because you're giving yourself to this in a way that a straightforward historian would not. You're giving it your creative imagination. You're allowing those stories to inspire further stories. I'm sure you dream about this. I'm sure you know, you're visited by it in all the realms of the mind. That's one of the strengths of Blanche's writing, that she's so open to this, and that she's also capable, because she is such an accomplished writer, to express it, because it's not enough just to receive it, one also has to express it. So I want to ask you a little bit more about Guillaume's transition, but before I do that, can you tell us a little bit about your developing relationship with Eleanor of Aquitaine? And she's not so prominent in this book, but I'm kind of hoping that she will come to greater prominence in the later books. And I want to know a little bit more about how you see her, you Blanche, how you see her.
I'm a great admirer.
Yes, of course.
First up, I'd just like to say one thing about the 12th century. But people have the view that they died at 40 and were sort of this high. That's not true at all. Eleanor had 10 children and died at 81. A horrible son, Richard the Lionheart, an absolutely vile man, was 6'5". Yeah, we know that from the tombs and the armour. And her lover, Henry's father, was about 6'3" or 4" also. She does play a greater role in the book I'm writing at the moment, book three, and she will play a greater role in book four, though, of course, Henry put her in jail for 15, or almost 16 years. So during that time, there was still a lot she could do. But she had raised a rebellion against him, and that's why he had her locked up. But I admire her greatly as a woman. She was very fiery. She was very determined to have power.
Yes, yes. Yes, she was very determined to have power, and she also understood what power was. And in a way, the connection between Henry and Eleanor is a constant kind of transference of power. There's no kind of... there are moments of great accord, but then they're very quickly disrupted and they become moments of discord again, because that's actually what they were fighting for. They were fighting for territory, and he was fighting for the territory in the sense of her body, because she was bringing forward all these heirs, and she was fighting for territory beyond her body. So, you know, it's very, very potent stuff. In fact, I made several notes thinking, gosh, the 12th century was not for the faint-hearted.
it wasn't for the faint-hearted. And I think there's a lot of sex in this book, but I think I should point out to people that it was the major pastime of the upper classes. Hunting, of course, during the day.
War,
yes. Henry avoided war if he could. But at night, they weren't watching television. And they didn't attempt to read at night, because the light wasn't good enough. Those who did and could read or enjoyed reading, Henry certainly did. So they did spend a tremendous amount of time engaged in sex, and were consequently very good at it. as happens if you practice a lot, I think. And there was also the strong belief that a woman couldn't get pregnant unless she had an orgasm. So they concentrated on helping that happen. As you know, it wasn't such a bad thing at all. It should be brought back.
I want to return you a little bit to this quite mysterious, in some ways, character of Guillaume, the half-brother of Henry, because in the book you allow him to carry some of the kind of potency of spiritual transformation. There are other echoes in the book that I particularly found fascinating, where people are either experiencing something through a dream or through the sense of an inner voice or an inner wisdom. So Blanche gives a very strong picture that people had a real sense of inspiration from beyond themselves and from beyond the material world. And I found that very, very convincing, and I found it completely unproblematic also. But at the same time, people weren't brought, because of those experiences, to any degree of spiritual... I mean to use the word piety in its real sense, not as something kind of fake, but as something committed. That's interesting, isn't it? That on the one hand, you're bringing us characters who kind of access the spiritual in a very natural way, and yet their conduct is not... I mean, they don't grow in compassion.
Guillaume being the exception.
Yes, but in the first book, there were genuinely pious people. Bernard of Clairvaux, for example, who built Chartres Cathedral, had it built. I don't know that he was so compassionate, now you come to mention it. But,
nor
yes.
Pious.
Eh?
Nor pious.
Well, I don't know. He was a mystic. It was a time of mysticism. It was a time when people believed in relics that they could have themselves cured of all sorts of illnesses through going and praying to relics or being in the presence of relics. And it was a time of great superstition, of course, and ignorance, and people made up stories to explain things that they didn't know about. For example, that birds in winter turned into fish and lived underwater, and suddenly when spring came, they leapt into the sky again, turned back into birds. So when you have those sort of beliefs about the natural world, and the supernatural world was presented to you all the time as being present and being helpful or punishing, punitive, it's not so strange.
Mm-hmm. And what inspired you with that? What inspired
Stephanie asked...
I just asked what inspired her to explore that, because it certainly adds a marvellous dimension to the story.
Well, I'm somebody, Stephanie, as you know only too well, who's had a very long spiritual path and life. I think we first met in the Quakers. And I think it's those many years of spiritual practice that made me able to be in accord with people at that time who also had spiritual experiences. So I would say what brought me to that was that I've had so many spiritual experiences through meditation and spiritual practice over the years. They're just natural to me, and I know they're real.
And also they were so natural to those characters, and that's one of the lovely things that Blanche is able to really bring forward, the naturalness of those so-called supernatural experiences. Even, for example, in the most dramatic of them, which is where this character, again returning to him, Guillaume, is taken care of by some forest women. And it's one of the most beautiful and evocative parts of the book, because most of the book takes place... where we are dealing with the highest levels of power, you know, with so much at stake and so much ruthlessness and so on. So when we literally go into the forest, we begin to see the trees. It's quite a beautiful, powerful contrast. But just before we run out of time and begin to take questions from the floor, I also want to ask you, Blanche, when you are emerging from your immersion in your 12th century life and your everyday life in the 21st century, and you're moving backwards and forwards between those times, which you're doing over a very, very long period to produce four major books, that are all connected to one another, and to do it with such fluency, again, as I said at the very beginning of this, is, you know, an extraordinary intellectual accomplishment as well as a creative one. But when you're moving between the centuries, you know, morning in the 12th and afternoon in the 21st, what are the particular lessons of the 12th century that you're bringing to the 21st century? And conversely, when you return to the 12th century, what insights are you able to take from the 21st?
Oh, Stephanie.
I think that it's...
Yeah. I don't think I can answer that. I don't know. I do live at 24/7, so I appear to be living in the 21st century, but actually I'm living in the 12th. And that's where my head is all the time, and unfortunately sometimes when I'm driving it's where it is too.
But I can
imagine that. Ian RMA sort of comes to my help there.
Well, your understanding of how power...
I think my understanding of power has informed a lot of it. And power is something that doesn't change. And the exercise of power is something that doesn't really change over time. Although that was he was an absolute monarch, and we live in a democracy, those tensions and pulls and pushes remain the same. Yes.
Yes, they do. But would you say, to return to Henry, who is your central figure, your love, in this enormous project, would you say that he learnt something about what power does to one? Or did he learn also how to use power with greater skill and subtlety? And how have you brought those lessons into your writing?
Well, that's kind of impossible to answer, because you have to wait till the end of the book.
Oh, right.
To the end of the series. But he certainly learns how to use power and when he's misused it, and the punishment for doing that. And yes, I don't think I can say anything more, because it's jumping ahead too far. But the book I'm writing at the moment is about the struggle between him and Thomas Becket.
And finally, before we turn to questions from the floor, I would really like to know what it was in the two books that you have already written so far, what it was that most surprised you, either about Henry or Eleanor, or the struggles between them, or the struggles of the time, or with the introduction of Thomas. Where has there been a real surprise for you?
Oh. But you surprise us as readers constantly.
Look, I think there have been lots. I think it's like this carpet. There are lots of surprises there. There's a pattern of surprises. I think in being able to write, for example, battle scenes, in the first book, I didn't imagine I could ever write a battle scene. I didn't imagine I could ever write a long scene about a boar hunt, never having hunted wild boar myself. Those kind of things surprised me, and also writing about the forest people. And I'm really pleased you brought that up, because I want to convey how thickly wooded England was. I was talking to a very knowledgeable man on the weekend who pointed out that in Julius Caesar's day, obviously that was a lot earlier, but in Caesar's day you could travel from Paris to Warsaw in the height of summer and never see sunlight, because the forests were so thick. Obviously in the intervening centuries they were cut down, but then when the Roman Empire collapsed, the Western Roman Empire collapsed, the trees took over again. So during the Dark Ages, they grew back. And I think this is another thing that really informed people's minds, that they were surrounded by forests and the sort of spirits that people feel, even in Australia, they feel live in our forests.
Well, I think that was just an introduction, but I hope you've all gathered how, you know, extraordinarily fascinating these two books are, with still two to go. And, you know, we don't want to rush you, not at all, because, you know, this is just an extraordinarily major work. But I'm sure you've got some questions, and I don't know whether Jared wants to field the questions.
I'll field the questions, I think. otherwise I lose control.
Well, we could have a coup.
So I just want to remind people that copies of Blanc d'Auberger's most recent in this quartet, The Lion Rampant, Janet Grundy's got copies of that, and some copies of the earlier book, The Young Lion. It's the first time anyone's commented on the pattern of the carpet at the Gallipoli Club, but I'm sure the owners of the club will much appreciate it. I think it's a very fine carpet myself.
Writers notice everything, Gerard.
And I should say a special welcome to former Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who's come along tonight, so it's great to see you here. So we'll just start off question discussion. I want everyone to speak up because I want their comments to be picked up by the microphones, and if I repeat or maybe Stephanie repeats it, it'll be just because people can't hear it. You spoke about spiritual experiences. Apart from experiences, I guess it would be impossible to write a history of 12th century England or France if you didn't also understand Christianity and the history of Christianity. So how does that come into it?
Oh, I spent a very long time in a Christian church, and I've done a great deal of reading in Christian history and dogma and belief, so that's how it comes into it.
There's a question here. Yeah.
Yes, recently I heard someone say that Joan of Arc was a schizophrenic. I wondered if you would say that her experiences were quite, would be accepted as fairly normal.
Now we've got up to Joan of Arc. Are you...
So the question was that somebody has said that Jeanne d'Arc was a schizophrenic, and what would be my view? My view is that she was having
visions,
and she wasn't a schizophrenic at all, and it's ridiculous.
Okay, there's a question here. Yeah, don't stand in front of the camera. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just sit down then.
Yep.
Look, I'm a bit of a fan of Eleanor.
Absolutely.
Yeah, have been for many years. And something that has always troubled me is the way that the church has blighted or played with her reputation. She was somebody who was, to be frank, often presented as a slut by the church.
Mm.
The church would never do anything to endorse her because they saw her as a slut. Now, there's lots of different reasons for that, and I won't bore the whole room with them.
No.
But one question, how do you see her, and the way that you've presented her in your first book as very sexually open, is that something you found from first sources? Is that something that you discovered through the readings about her? Or is that something that you've brought to her from your world experience?
So the suggestion is the church has been very tough on Eleanor because of her sexual activities. And where did you get your evidence for this proposition?
It's in the histories that she was sexually liberated.
Yeah, just answer. You go.
Sorry, go.
Oh, I'm now confused about what.
I guess my question is, in those histories, I see a lot of the church maligning her.
Yeah, we've got to be brief. The suggestion is the church is maligning her. Okay.
Well, the church was beginning maligning all women, and so strong women were more of a threat than weak ones. So it was going through a process which had gathered force under Pope Gregory the Seventh, Gregory the Great, who reinstituted and insisted upon celibacy for the clergy, which had really gone by the board. It was there in the early church, it went by the board for centuries, and the Gregorian reforms demanded a celibate clergy. And once you rejecting wives and to that extent, women to that extent, well, of course they're going to turn into aliens and wicked people. So I think that's what's socially what we're seeing happening at this time. Gregory's reforms were still not wholly accepted. Bishops still had wives. They tended to call them their housekeepers, and their children that they tended to call their nieces and nephews.
Right. So. Stephanie, have you got a contribution? Oh, sorry. Question here. Yep.
It always struck me that the big issue of the time was the great struggle between church and state. Now, I won't be jumping ahead of it too much, but anyway. in your view, did Henry II do anything to diminish the power of the church, which was only finally almost brought to its knees by Henry VIII, centuries on? But did Henry II make any inroads on the power of the church at that time?
So has your story got something to do with the conflict between church and state?
Very much. In book three, it's completely focused on that. It's the struggle between Henry and Becket, whom Henry somewhat foolishly, you would say, at a superficial level, you'd say it was foolish, made Archbishop of Canterbury. Henry thought he could use Becket to reform the church, particularly the criminis clerks, as they're called. One in every six men in England at the time could claim benefit of clergy and could not be tried in civil courts for things like rape and murder and theft. And Henry was determined to bring law, because he was very much a law-giving king, into the church. And the struggle with Becket was the trigger for their huge fight was precisely on that issue of Henry trying to bring reforms into the church and Becket resisting.
Sorry,
can I just make another remark? I think something that Blanche also shows so well is the kind of the blatant hypocrisy, but how seductive that was. So it's incredibly ironic, for example, that Henry, who had no illusions about Becket's amorality, at least as Blanche creates him, brought him in to try to clean up the church. I mean, the irony of that is awful, as is the irony that Becket was finally accepted as a saint by both the Catholic and Protestant sectors of life, while Eleanor, as you say, was often disparaged. But in fact, she, by any measure, would have done far, far less harm.
Well, they were politicians, don't forget. I mean, many, many bishops of the time were barons and were straight-up politicians, and then they happened to become princes of the church. So it isn't so odd, really. These were people who were exercising power, and considerable power, and one of their great sources of power was relics.
Meaning? Just explain that.
Oh, relics were bits and pieces that had belonged to previous saints, or a little bit of the True Cross, or somebody's Saint John's finger, and all sorts of nonsense.
And they were selling these.
No, they had them on display in churches, and people would go and stand and pray to the relic, and then the relic would help them if they were lucky. And of course, if in the case of illness, as we know today, 30% of people are cured by placebos, so the relics probably had a 30% cure rate, and that's not very surprising.
It's a good rate, yeah.
But talking about relics, they even had flasks of the Virgin's milk, you know.
Oh. Yes.
And St. John, they found two heads for him.
Well,
look, you can always turn a dollar somehow.
Yeah, absolutely.
For those who want to pick up, the suggestion is that either St. John was born with or died with two heads, and that sort of helped the relic industry. I mean, I don't know, actually, yeah. He never told me either way. But we got a question here? Yep.
Yes. Can I get back to this lady about Eleanor? The histories were written by the church, and they were very anti-Eleanor. She was very potent. Every time she had sex, I mean, she only had sex with Louis twice, and she had two daughters. With Henry, she had eight children. Now, if she went with all these other men she spoke to, that she'd had countless kids. No, I think she was true blue.
The suggestion is that Eleanor was more modest than others have made out, I think.
Well, they did know quite a lot about sex, as I said, and I don't know where you get the idea she only had sex with Louis twice. I think that's...
No,
well, we can't really go into this now because it's...
because we're in the Gallipoli Club.
It's a bit complicated. For the, yeah, the Gallipoli Club is a little bit complicated. David Day. Yeah.
I was just wondering, you will have lived with Henry for so many years by the time you finished your quartet. Could you then imagine turning around and writing that long-awaited biography of him? And how difficult would that be for you?
I'm writing the biography of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a fictional biography. I mean, you're using your imagination much more than you would if you'd written a sort of a non-fiction.
So the question is, would you write a non-fiction biography of Henry?
No.
Why not?
Because it wouldn't be nearly so interesting. And it wouldn't be so true.
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Stephanie, you want to make a comment?
Yes, I do want to make a comment, because what Blanche brings is her possession by these characters. She's possessed by them, clearly. And so she thinks for them and thinks her way into them. And she expresses that with the skill of a fiction writer. And, you know, there's a kind of vividness to this that, even though you are also an accomplished biographer, but the art of fiction gives us an immediacy that even the most brilliant biography can't. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I do agree. And there are some things that straight-up historians, because they're just dealing with the facts, they miss things that are standing there in plain sight, which if you're a fiction writer, you can actually see. And one of them is the final murder of Becket and who done it and why. And it was over a very personal matter. It was the man who murdered him deeply loved Henry's brother, William, and Becket, out of sheer bloody-mindedness, had forbidden William to marry the woman he loved, and William died of a broken heart. And this was something that absolutely enraged people against Becket, because it was seen as malice, which it was.
So just taking on that question, how do you reckon, because you've written on these subjects before, a fictional account of Sir Richard Kirby or R.J. Hawke would work?
Next question.
I think they'd work rather well.
Right, so where are we? Stephanie, how do you think that'd work?
I think it would work all too well, and that probably Blanche should stay with her medieval times, because she is giving us so much with this, and also we can get to know, we can have our own opinions about R.J. Hawke, you know, he's right here with us, whereas she's having to bring Henry, you know, forward through the centuries, and not just Henry, you know, Henry is central here. But what I want to emphasise is that she's bringing the times of this passionate time forward to us. And I think teaching us something really very, very relevant about our the wisdom of being a little bit cautious about lusting after too much power.
So is it final...
Yes, that's very fair.
We're going to be brief and then we'll have a final... Yes?
Yes. You said a lot of these kings and people were very tall. At that time, would you say the peasantry were reasonably well-fed and reasonably...
The question is, in 12th century England, were the peasantry in France, were the peasantry reasonably well-fed?
There had been two centuries of very, very good weather. And so the answer to that is, by and large, yes. In England, there'd been the problem of a 19-year-long civil war in which a lot of crops were destroyed and people were starving at the end of it. But by and large, yes, they were big, strong people. And in fact, that has proven. The graves in London excavated have shown that 12th century women were slightly larger than 20th century women.
This is a final question. I mean, it's quite an achievement. You've now got two volumes. You're into, or the two accounts, you're into the third of the quartet. How do you do it? What? How do you go about writing it? What are you going to do tomorrow, in other words?
I get to work every morning between 8:30 and 9:30, and I work until about 1:30. Then I go home and eat and have a little nap, and then I often go back and do some editing. I don't attempt to write in the afternoon, only corrections. But it's 5 days a week, and usually then a couple of extra hours one day of the weekend. So it's a full-time job.
It is a full-time job.
Stephanie, a final comment from you?
Well, I think that we should all be incredibly grateful to Blanche that she's taken this on our behalf, as it were. She's taken us on this incredible journey, you know, across the centuries, into the lives of these highly intelligent, formidable, fascinating people. This is something that very, very few people would take on. Blanche has taken it on. She's taken it on with great courage and great panache, and I think we should really thank her for it. And I really thank Stephanie.
Thank you, my dear.
And I would like to thank both of them. Many thanks to Blanche Dobrzej, but also to Stephanie Darrick for a terrific conversation between the two of you. Until volume, the third one.
Don't you pinch my book.
That's it, folks. Thanks for coming.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.